Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of England, episode 268A. This episode is released on the 21st of March 2019, which, if my maths is correct, which it usually isn't, it has to be said, is the 463rd anniversary of the death of a man who I've rather come to both admire and like over the last 18 months or so of writing about the times in which he lived. This is Thomas Cranmer, whose name I think is less remembered now than it once was, but who still very much deserves to be remembered. I appreciate that I'm in danger of sounding just a little bit fanboyish about my guest in today's episode, and I appreciate this is not dignified, but look, who cares? I have thoroughly enjoyed every single work I've read by Professor Diarmaid MacCulloch, whether about the Commotion Time or the Tudor Church Militant, and the biography of Thomas Cranmer was just fantastic. I'm not going to lie to you. It's not the sort of thing you dash off on a Sunday afternoon after the sports pages, roast beef and all the trimmings, but it is a work of both immense rigour and integrity, and at the same time, wit and a great sense of drama and narrative. I have written a review at thehistoryofengland.co.uk that you might like to look at, or forget all that, just go and buy the thing. Anywho, today we have the conversation that I was privileged to have with Diarmaid about the life of Thomas Cranmer. Just a bit of housekeeping first. This is effectively next Sunday's episode, and I have a week off thereafter, so we'll be back to Mary on the 7th of April. I hope you enjoy the interview, and I hope that today you will raise a glass or a thought or a prayer to Thomas Cranmer, whichever is your idiom. So welcome, everybody. I am very lucky to be invited back to talk to Diarmaid MacCulloch. Thank you very much, Diarmaid.
Pleasure to see you again.
And the occasion is Thomas Cranmer. Another figure who I think we share an admiration for, but for whom I feel slightly confused. So I'm hoping you're going to help me.
Mm.
And I think you wrote what's normally described as the definitive biography about 9 years ago, or 1999,
well, a long time ago, a quarter of a century ago, but I have revised it, tidied it up a bit 3 or 4 years back.
Right, okay. So cast your mind all the way back to when you originally thought of writing. What drew you to Thomas Cranmer as a subject?
Well, someone asked me to do it. Publisher asked me to do it, and I needed a book. I decided I would like to take that offer up. It seemed the great thing about doing it was that it gave me the chance to look at all of early Tudor England, and at mid stage in my career, I guess it was, and it certainly proved to be so. Mm. And I remember reading the great Reformation historians to start with. So I read John Stripe and I read Bishop Gilbert Burnet cover to cover. Not sure many people do these days. And that gave me a marvellous overview of what everyone thought at the time. And I have a great respect for Burnet. Mm. So I think most of Burnet's conclusions are really very good. Mm. And of course, Burnet was an uninhibited Protestant.
Right.
So he had a sort of vested interest in liking Cranmer. But it's quite a fair shrewd picture. So I took it from there, and that would be in the late 80s, early 90s, right. And spent 5 years working on it. Came out in 1995 to start with. So it was a very big project, and as you know, I've done a similar project on Cromwell, and they're sort of bookends, right. Which have told me so much about how early Tudor England worked.
So that's how long it takes to write a biography. Is it 5 years, by and large, or does it get quicker?
Certainly it does for a Tudor one, where you've got the sources, which are huge. For Cranmer, they're not as large as they are for Thomas Cromwell, but there's a lot of stuff, and so you do have to get around it.
So he, I guess, Cranmer goes all the way through a very, very important period of the Reformation. His views change over time. Since you mention Burnet, the reputation and the historiography of the period has changed a lot, and of Cranmer has changed a lot. Do you think we've travelled too far in a particular direction, or where do you think we are in the historiography? How did this view change?
The problem was that he was the architect of the Protestant Reformation, and he was also Archbishop of Canterbury, so he had lots of successors as Archbishop of Canterbury. And the Church of England changed from its Reformation persona, the sort of church that Cranmer had wanted to see happen, happened. And it was very much a church of the Reformed Protestant wing. It wasn't even Lutheran. And other Reformed churches look alarmingly Protestant in tooth and claw for the other side of what happened next in the Church of England. A Church of England which was embarrassed by the Reformation, which, of course, its wing has taken on the name Anglo-Catholic in the Oxford movement of the 19th century. These people did not want the Church of England to be Protestant. The trouble was that it had been, and Cranmer was at the centre of it. He'd also left it a liturgy, a Book of Common Prayer, which was still the liturgy of the Church of England. It was the way everyone worshipped who were in the Church of England. And so the Oxford movement and the Anglo-Catholics were stuck with this prayer book, which contained lots of things they didn't actually like very much, and they spent a huge amount of 19th century intellectual energy proving that Cranmer was not who he was.
Right.
So we've got this picture of Cranmer as the moderate mediator between a violent Reformation and something more reasonable, and also going back to the medieval church. And you get the most extraordinary distortions of the man in 19th century history. In the 20th century, the sort of people who were then interested in him tended to be much more secular. So they regarded him often as the agent of Henry VIII and the agent of Edward VI, instead of an independent player whose ideas were changing furiously during his life. That's what makes him confusing. So what I tried to do is to get back to the Cranmer he would recognise as much as one can. And that's a Protestant red in tooth and claw.
Right.
And I did something visually in a sleight of hand on this, because when I chose the dust jacket, I didn't go for the picture which was absolutely standard up to the 1960s, 70s, and had been used, for instance, on Pollard's biography, A.F. Pollard's biography in the 20th century, still being used later on. No, I went for another portrait, which is in Lambeth Palace. And in contrast to smooth-chinned, thoughtful-looking Cranmer in his picture of 1545-6, this is a Cranmer with a big, bushy beard. Yeah. This is Cranmer in the reign of Edward VI. And that seems to me to be a much better image of the man than the earlier picture, which had been painted in that very tense period, the last years of Henry VIII, when things were swaying either way, and Cranmer was trying to create a particular image which would not be that of Cranmer under Edward VI.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you about that, because it's got to be the smooth-chinned Cranmer for me, always looks a bit more grim, which I was probably the opposite. Because I understand the beard thing is around a protest against the traditional religion, and
the longer the beard, the more Protestant you
were. Is that right? Well, but it has to say, he looks less red in tooth and claw to my eye than in the beardy one than he does in the smooth one.
Perhaps he'd mellowed with the years.
Maybe that's it, yes. Or maybe it's my own.
Bit Father Christmas.
Bit Father Christmas, that's it. So I'm going backwards then. What do we know about Cranmer's married life? Because, of course, he gives his wife something of a checkered history, in a sense.
Well, he was a man who liked marriage, because he married twice. He married as a young Cambridge scholar. which shows you that he really did like marriage, because this was a bar to a career at the time.
Right.
Getting married meant that he couldn't proceed to the priesthood, and he only proceeded because the wife died in childbirth, right, as did the child. So that first marriage we know very little about. Mm. But then the second marriage is tremendously interesting and is part of his intellectual religious journey, because when on embassy for King Henry VIII in the matter of getting rid of Queen Catherine of Aragon by some diplomatic means, he found himself in the Holy Roman Empire. He found himself in Nuremberg, which was already a great Lutheran city. It had rebelled against the old church. And this is probably the first time that Cranmer had met such an open institutional form of Protestantism. Mm. And he did something quite remarkable in Nuremberg. He married. He married the niece of the leading Lutheran pastor of the city, a man called Andreas Osiander. So doing that, which is, it's 1532, he's really saying something quite bold. He's saying, I no longer care about the old church's prohibition of clerical marriage. And he wasn't taking a mistress, which many senior clergy did at the time. He was marrying a wife. Mm. So this is a very overt, considered thing to do, and we don't quite know where they got married. I suspect in Osiander's huge parish church, which you can still visit in Nuremberg, St. Lawrence, wonderful, beautiful building. Right, but who knows? Anyway, by the time that he left Nuremberg, he was a married man. He married Margareta. We don't know her surname, because we know she's a niece of this pastor Osiander. We never have found it out. And what happened to Margareta after that is also a bit puzzling. I don't think she came to England for a while, though she certainly was here 8 years later when she had to be sent back to Germany because Henry VIII was cracking down on married clergy. And they had children probably only in the reign of Edward VI. That's interesting. Mm. The surviving kids were a boy and two girls, who, it has to be said, never came to much.
Right.
And I suppose the trauma of what had happened to their father might have accounted for that. So, yeah, Margareta is part of the story, hugely important part.
There was a rumour at one stage that she was kept in a box or something. Did I got that wrong?
This was a Catholic canard, I think.
Okay.
It's a complicated story, but there was a fire in Cranmer's palace in Canterbury, at which he showed very great solicitude for a box and had it rescued. I suspect it carried papers about the crisis, political crisis he was in at the time. But someone clearly in a joke said, well, must be his wife in there, take all that care over it. And the Catholics picked that up.
Right.
So no, I don't think the box is true. But her career after that is remarkable, because after his death, when she was effectively a non-person with three kids to look after, she first married Cranmer's publisher and then married Cranmer's publisher's friend. And at one stage, it's bizarre, she gets involved in curious ménage à trois at that stage, with two people and her in the same household. And we know this because there are lawsuits about property. So what one makes of all that, I don't know.
Right.
But she was a lady who much experienced marriage and had a rather torrid life.
Absolutely, yeah. It'd be nice to know more about it, but yes, I didn't have problems. There's a tradition then that Cranmer was radicalised at Little Germany, or what, the White Tavern, is it?
The White Horse Tavern. Probably not.
Right.
This all comes from one reference in John Fox's great book, Acts and Monuments, to Little Germany, or Germany as he calls it. Little comes from somewhere else.
Right.
And he lists one or two people who went there, but Cranmer was not among them.
Okay.
So it's become one of those sort of foundation legends, I think, for Cambridge self-esteem, but also for Protestant origins. No, it's most unlikely that he had anything to do with it, because in his Cambridge years he seems to have been a religious conservative. Okay. This came as a surprise to me, but there it was. I found one of his books in the British Library, and it was a book owned by him, bought by him in Cambridge, clearly in the 1520s. It's a book by John Fisher against Martin Luther. And in it are Cranmer's marginalia, his personal comments. And
you'd expect them, wouldn't you, to be on the side of Luther, but they're not. They're on the side of Fischer. And he says terrible things about Luther. He says he's wicked and mad for destroying the church's unity. So that's Cranmer in the very years that he ought to have been sitting in Little Germany, the White Horse, with Protestants. No, he wasn't. He was a conservative, conventional don who, interestingly, did not go to Oxford, along with many of the young Protestants who Cromwell recruited for the Cardinal's College there. Cranmer, it says in Fox, refused to go. So there we are. I think it's game, set and match.
Right. So how does he then, how did he become a reformer then? What was his route then?
Well, it seems to me that it was actually doing the thinking for the king's separation from his first wife. Because that involved saying that a previous pope had not had the right to grant the conditions for the marriage to have taken place. And once you start thinking along those lines, you think, well, who does have authority in the church? And the next person along is the king. And Cranmer was looking at sources which we know now were completely spurious, medieval English history, making English kings much, bigging them up much more than they ought to. But for him, this probably was conclusive, that the king was the source of God's authority in the church, not the pope. And so it seems strange now, but it does look as if it's the matter of Henry VIII's marriages, Catherine and Anne Boleyn, which really did persuade Cranmer that the pope was a liar.
And one of the questions I always thought seems to hang over Cranmer is, it's a question of honesty. I mean, I'm not sure I'm being fair there, but there's almost a suggestion that, well, he convinced himself because this is a route to power and influence, and he kind of did the king's work. Mm. But your feeling was that, and this is a genuine belief that he...
Oh, I think so, because of the vehemence with which he ended up as a Protestant. Mm. And it's a complicated route through, and he's clearly a thoughtful man who didn't come to decisions quickly. And there are confusions and what you might call hypocrisies on the route. For instance, his only known parish ministry, in inverted commas, was a very rich parish in Breedon in Worcestershire, which was given him by an Italian cardinal while Cranmer was on embassy in Rome. And you know, that doesn't look very Protestant.
No, it doesn't look great, does it?
And it's at the same time that he's doing all this thinking for the king. I just think people were confused and didn't know where things are going to go. You know, one thinks of Brexit. big things that you can't quite see the whole shape of, but you know you want to go in one direction. So I think we're seeing that sort of confusion. And there is no doubt that once he has made his mind up, by which time he was Archbishop of Canterbury, he was consistently pushing for reformation in Henry VIII's very ambiguous church. He was pushing further than the king wanted.
And yet he changes, doesn't he? Or as far as I can see, he's not... And people pick up on this, don't they? It becomes a weakness later, as far as I can see, that actually he continues to change. And and that causes a problem for him.
Well, yes, I mean, doubting Thomas Cranmer, he's being called, doubting Thomas the Apostle, and it's in, you can see why. He does change, and the changes have started with him ceasing to be that very conventional Cambridge don, very traditionalist, through to something that looks a bit more like Lutheran Protestantism under Henry, through to something much more thoroughgoing and reformed in the reign of Edward. So those are changes. And he admitted it at his trial that he changed on very basic things like what does the Eucharist mean? He said, I had two beliefs on that.
So he does seem to be quite a self-aware man. I was drawn to one of your quotes, actually, that it's after the Act of Six Articles, obviously very traditionalist, and I think he's writing a letter to somebody who is going to leave England and going to go to the continent because he can't put up with it. He writes, so you must make haste to escape before the island may be cut off, unless you're willing to sign the decree, as I have done, compelled by fear, for I repent of what I have done, and if I had known that my only punishment would have been deposition from the archbishopric, I would not have subscribed. So he's kind of self-loathing almost about what he's done.
There is a terrible honesty there, isn't there? And I think throughout his career people played on that, particularly in the psychological destruction of him under Mary.
And I think that's one of the things why I find him an interesting and attractive character, that there is that self-awareness around him. But why I find it confusing, because as well, I mean, I'm leaping forward, but if I take you to the affair of Joan Boucher, there's a very different Cranmer that emerges from that affair than an image you might pick up of a rather kindly, self-doubting man.
Yes, and that has got lost over the years because he's been recast as a sort of gentle Anglican parson. No, there is a very hard-edged side to him, and it is a theological edge. So you can see the people he hated. He hated, on one side, the Franciscan observant friars, because he saw them as the shock troops of the Pope, the agents of Antichrist, therefore. But he was equally implacable against very radical Protestants, one might. Well, they're not even Protestants. They're beyond Protestants. So you mentioned Joan. Well, she had denied the Trinity. She was, in other words, what contemporaries would abusively call an Anabaptist, because of another belief in adult baptism. And those sort of things he abhorred, because he regarded them as corrupting truth. And so the punishment for that would be death.
Right. And I think Edward VI tries to argue him out of it, doesn't it?
It's said by John Fox. Oh, okay, yes, right. And that's possible. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Because Fox himself hated the whole.
Fox hated persecution. Yeah. One of the very rare people who thought it was a very bad idea to burn people. Mm. Not many people in the 16th century.
No, indeed. Along with that. Yes. Okay. So sorry, I've leapt forward, but so he receives the pallium from the Pope, and I think he's the last Archbishop to do so, or is that?
Yeah. Well, he, of course, Cardinal Poole would also do so, but the last Archbishop of a Protestant nature, and that's it's hypocritical. It's a fix. The pallium was a symbol of obedience to Rome, and the next thing he did, I mean, literally, the next thing was to repudiate that obedience in the ceremony. So, not a good moment.
So there's a period in the 40s, aren't there, where Henry VIII is still king, but there's this prebendary's plot where he comes very close to losing his grip on his life, probably.
Yeah.
What does that tell us about Cranmer and his relationship with Henry?
Well, it shows how evenly balanced things were in the 1540s after Thomas Cromwell's execution. Things could have swayed either way, and the things were also getting pretty murderous. The people who destroyed Thomas Cromwell wanted to do the same trick again on Cranmer, and it's this very same sort of setting up accusations, getting the king to agree to an arrest. And the next step must be making sure that the victim never sees the king again. The trouble was, it worked with Cromwell, who was in the tower, never saw the king again after his arrest, but it didn't work with Cranmer, who, as luck would have it, had a secretary whose brother was in the king's private apartments, the Privy Chamber, and the brother tipped off Cranmer's secretary. Cranmer's secretary tipped off his boss, who then could promptly be rowed across in his barge from Lambeth to the Privy Stair in Whitehall, go up the Privy Stair, because he was recognised, and then see the king personally. And so that was the vital difference. He looked the king in the eye and presumably said, you surely cannot do this to me. And Henry, a real coward, actually, particularly when you looked at him straight in the eye, said, no, okay, and gave him the ring, a royal ring. And that's what Cranmer could simply give and show to the people who were going to arrest him the following day. So the story turned out differently, but it's the same team on either side. It's anti-Cromwellians, anti-Reformation people against this embattled group of what I would call evangelicals at court.
So you have this lovely scene, don't you, where he's accused in the council chamber and he produces his ring, which must have been a fist pump occasion. He must have gone back and, what a great moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, and I reflect that he was on the council, I guess, for about 20 years or so, wasn't he? I kind of feel I know how I would have reacted to Cromwell had I met him. I find it very difficult to visualise how people would have reacted to Cranmer in that political situation on the King's Council. How do you think Stephen Gardiner reacted to him, for example?
Well, Gardiner and Cranmer were clearly enemies for their public careers. I think they'd been mates at Cambridge. So there's a genuine ideological rift between them, but also the fact that Gardiner knew painfully that he could have been Archbishop of Canterbury and was expecting, I think, to be Archbishop. He'd abandoned Wolsey, set himself up near Queen Anne, and under the king's powers, secretary to the king, all that said Archbishop of Canterbury. Didn't get it. So resentment there, but also increasing ideological, theological horror at Cranmer, and that there was never reconciliation there.
So was he an effective politician, Cranmer?
No, I think to start with, not at all, and didn't need to be because of Thomas Cromwell. They had a slightly rocky start in that Cranmer was very much Anne Boleyn's sidekick. Cromwell, as I've argued, was really her enemy. But they came together and clearly worked together, and in terms of getting the Reformation forward, Cromwell could be the hatchet man. So it's really when Cromwell fell that Cranmer started having to be a politician. You know, by the reign of Edward VI, clearly he's quite a hard-nosed politician, as well as being a churchman and liturgist, etc.
So he learns, you think?
Had to learn the hard way, I think.
Yeah.
And particularly the prebendary's plot you've mentioned.
Yeah.
And this is facing him with destruction, and he got through it.
Yeah. We come to Edward VI's reign, and in a sense he's off the leash. What religious life did Cranmer want for the country?
He wanted something like one of the great reformed Protestant cities of Europe. Strasbourg would be probably his ideal, because he was a great friend of Martin Bucer, the great reformer there. So that would be the model for a kingdom. And the problem is, how do you transfer a relatively small, circumscribed reformation like Strasbourg's onto the stage of an entire kingdom? And that was the problem under Edward VI. It's huge. And you have to move very carefully. And the problem was also, for instance, in Parliament, that actually probably a majority of his colleagues loathed what he was up to. Among the bishops in the House of Lords, there are the secular peers who might be traditionalist. House of Commons you've got to deal with. So that's why the reign of Edward VI and the progress towards the Reformation is step by step, relatively slow, and then there's a lurch in the middle which had more to do with having destroyed the balance in the House of Lords, from traditionalists to evangelicals. That's the moment they could really let the leash off, and all the time Cranmer is behind this forward movement. He's not holding it back in any way at all.
And so you get this slightly strange period where you have these public pronouncements which are all very reassuring traditionalists, and then meanwhile you have, I don't know, the visitations going on which are quite radically changing the way churches look.
Yeah.
Is this political? Did he know where he wanted to go, or is it he achieving what he can achieve at each particular moment, or did he have a clear vision?
I've no doubt at all that he knew where he wanted to go, and he was pressing forward all the time. It's stage by stage by stage. And what's impressive to me is the fact that the trajectory of it, the movement towards Reformation, it's a smooth line through the great political hiatus of the reign, which is the fall of the Duke of Somerset and his replacement by Warwick, the Duke of Northumberland. The religious trajectory forward is a straight line. There's no sense of break there. And the one person who's around all that time through that crisis was Cranmer.
Right. I think somewhere else I'd read that, I mean, unlike many people, his argument doesn't seem to have been about the wealth of the church or its materialism, but very much about its theology. What did he think was important?
Well, he had no time for monasteries or friaries, absolutely none. He wasn't that enthusiastic about cathedrals.
Right.
The sort of use of his prayer book with choirs and organs and in evensong, he wouldn't understand what's happened to that.
Okay.
So the life which mattered to him was the life of the parish, the ordinary congregation and its minister, and the preaching of the word within that. It's a much narrower vision, frankly, than that of the medieval church. It's one route to God only, without all the glorious variety of medieval spirituality. But it very much reflects what was happening in reformed Protestant Europe generally. It's so similar to the sort of picture you get out of the church of Strasbourg, Zurich, any of the big cities of Central Europe.
That's one of the things that came across in the book, actually, that I tend to think of Cranmer as a very English figure.
Yeah.
But, of course, he was quite international as
yes,
well.
Yes, absolutely. He'd experienced mainland Europe and was a huge enthusiast for contacts with it, and drew refugees here when they needed to find a refuge under Edward VI. He kept agents abroad, informing him what was going on. I think Cromwell had started that, but he had his own contacts, and that went on. Had a young Polish gentleman in his household for 50s, 30s, and 40s. So there are all sorts of ways in which he's emphatically not English, and that's another myth about him, that he creates an English sort of Reformation. No, it's an international sort of Reformation.
So we come in 1549 and 1552 to the Books of Common Prayer, which are, you know, two of his most lasting achievements, I guess.
Yeah.
Talk to him about those and why they're seen as such great achievements.
What Cranmer had been wanting a liturgy in English since the 30s, and he put schemes up when it looked as if it might happen, even 1538. Nothing much happened. A litany, that's a sort of, that's a ceremonial procession for prayers, that was put in English in a crisis in the war with France. But 1549, things that he's got his chess pieces lined up now. And it's possible to put that through. There was a tryout with a little bit of English in the Mass, 1548. Then that's incorporated in a new prayer book, 49, which was clearly a shock to the nation. Just hearing the whole of the liturgy in English was a shock. And it provoked rebellion, specifically about the prayer book in 49 in the West Country. But it's still a compromise. And that's because he simply could not have got anything else through the House of Lords. Right. It's as simple as that. But with the political crisis of 1549, certain bishops being put in the Tower of London, others being dismissed, the balance shifted. By 1552, he got what he wanted. And so 1552 represents at least one big stage on Cranmer's achieving what he wanted. It's still quite an elaborate liturgy by mainland Europe's reformed standards, but it's lost a lot of the compromises of 1549. Mm. 49 is a very temporary book. No one liked it. Mm. And it's interesting the place that it then assumed in High Church Anglican historiography, understanding of history afterwards. As early as the 17th century, High Church Anglicans were looking to the 1549 book to justify their theology, which was simply not compatible with 1552. So 49 assumed a character after the event, which it really didn't have in Cranmer's thinking. As far as he was concerned, he junked it. Mm. He junked it, and the 52 book was the next stage on.
So do you think that was for him, was it? I mean, one of my questions I was going to ask is, at the end of Edward VI's reign, does he look back and think, you know, comes canon law, but theologically, that he's done what he wants to do?
No, I don't. I don't. There is the story preserved by, admittedly, what would be called Puritans later, that he had thought of a prayer book 100 times better than this one. Right. Had is the interesting thing there. I think that means would have in our idiom. Mm. And that probably represents his thinking that 52, that's okay, but we could do better, we could move on. Things had moved on in the very last year of Edward. You can see cathedrals dismantling their organs, for instance. And that's a sign that change was not going to stop carrying on.
Right. But one of his failures, I guess, is he has a scheme for also reforming canon law, and that doesn't happen. Where does that go wrong?
Well, this had been his cherished scheme, and it had been Henry VIII's scheme too, that back in the 30s they'd started a complete rehaul of canon law. And you see why, because canon law is the Pope's law. So you want something which isn't the Pope's law. And the scheme which came to fruition in 1552 was later called the Reformation of Laws, Reformatio Legum. But it's an entire scheme of reconstructing canon law on reformed Protestant lines. It does rather treat the whole of England like a vast reformed city, as if it were Strasbourg. But of course it was defeated, as you say. It was defeated, as far as we can see, as an act of malice by the secular politicians, the Duke of Northumberland, John Dudley in particular, because in the winter of 1552, a real row had developed between the church leadership and the secular leadership, both in government. Mm. But the churchmen thinking that the Reformation was turning into simple stripping of church assets, that these things were not being used well, they were simply being given out to the self-interested, and a campaign of preaching broke out. John Dudley, I think, very, very cross about that, and simply stepped in the law and said, we're not going to discuss this canon law thing anymore. And it never came back.
Right.
Never came back.
And was that, why was that significant? What impact did that have, if anything?
Because you need discipline for a reformed church. I mean, the marks of the church are where the sacraments are rightly ministered, the gospel rightly preached, and discipline. Most reformed Protestants would think these three were marks of the church. And discipline is, you know, it's one leg of a tripod. And if you lose that, then your reformation is impaired. So this is really, really very important. And I think a row would have gone on if the young king had not died so soon afterwards.
Some of the anti-papal rhetoric feel very foreign to modern ears. You know, it's very extreme, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was reading about a chap called John Ponnet,
Bishop of Winchester,
and about his developing theory of resistance to tyranny. That's not something that Cranmer would have signed up to, or is it?
No, certainly not. Ponnet was actually his chaplain.
Oh, okay.
A very, very clever man who never fulfilled his promise, died early. But I think in that respect, I very much doubt Cranmer would have approved. But because he's a political operator too, and he had been involved in trying to alter the succession. I mean, every side in a very polarised age did end up saying it is okay to get rid of monarchs who don't agree with us. So French Catholics got to that position too, got to the position of saying you can assassinate monarchs you don't agree with.
Right.
So Ponet is only part of the wider picture.
But for Cranmer, the primacy of the prince, as it were, was very central to his...
Tremendously central. And that, of course, brought him into tremendous problems when the monarch was not the one he wanted, Queen Jane, but Queen Mary, returning the church to Rome. What do you do if you said that everything depends on obedience to the monarch, and the monarch then takes you back to Rome? What are you to do? It's a huge psychological, theological problem for him.
So when Mary does come to the throne, does he not realise that he's effectively toast? Does he harbour any hope that he might survive?
I don't think he did.
Right.
But for once he decided to stay at Lambeth.
So why did he do that? Why didn't he run?
Who knows? Who knows? Every senior churchman in Edward's church had to make that decision, and some fled abroad and some didn't. I think he felt that he was in a particular position to support those who stayed and perhaps see where the Queen was going. Who would know? Because her first noises were quite tolerant, quite conciliatory. But clearly the hollowness of those soon emerged, as the hollowness of Edward's promises to conservatives had become apparent. But hers is far more thoroughgoing and with an element of understandable revenge, particularly on the man who had pronounced the annulment of her mother's marriage and then betrayed her by supporting Queen Jane.
She kind of, the impression I get rightly wrong is that she does kind of pursue Cranmer, but takes quite a while to do it.
Yes, there's a very curious phony war all through the latter part of the summer of 53, where he's in his palace, he's doing business, there it is in the archive, and you feel what a bizarre, weird time that must have been. You know, the Book of Common Prayer was still legal, though parishes were abandoning it all over England for the old mass. So it came to a crisis in early September, where the rumour went round that he was accepting the mass.
Right.
And at that point, he put out a very bold, clear, black and white statement, I am not. And that was the excuse for the Queen to arrest him. You almost feel that both sides said, OK, right, now's the time.
Right.
We've got to sort this out. Parliament was about to meet. And how could he possibly have sat in Parliament? Right. So early September, he was in prison, and in prison from then on.
So there are some occasions, are there not, in Cranmer's life where you can specifically point to refute the idea that that he was a trimmer who lacked courage. He supports Anne Boleyn, or tries to persuade the king. He supports Cromwell, I believe, doesn't he?
Yep.
And this occasion where he stays when he could have run, surely they point to a strong brand of integrity in the man.
I do, but it is confusing, and that's one of the reasons I liked him, because he's not consistent. There is heroism there, and it's heroism particularly when he's really with his back to the wall, and That seems to me psychologically much more interesting than the black and white heroes and martyrs which the Reformation loved.
Well, there are, of course, no black and white heroes in life either, but which is why, again, I like, because, yes, you've got that bit of self, that self-loathing quote that I got. There's very that self-awareness, that uncertainty, and yet, you know, when it comes down to it, he did make himself do things that others around him wouldn't.
Yes, quite exactly.
So he's kind of pursued by both Paul and Mary. And incidentally, you pronounced it Paul.
Paul, yes, we know it's pronounced Paul. Right. It was because of Protestant malicious jokes about that stinking Paul.
Ah, okay, rather than that.
Carnal fool was another one.
Oh, is that right? So I've been doing Paul all my life, and I've always thought I've been doing the wrong thing. Why have I done this piece of idiocy? And now I find I'm right.
You're
so,
right.
So they pursue him, don't they?
Yeah.
He recants, and yet they still keep pushing.
Yes, that does show a level of malevolence towards him, because he, as you know, signed 6 recantations, right, each more abject than the last, and the last 2 in the knowledge that he would be burned anyway. But you've got this feeling that this is a man who really, really matters. Mm. He's actually the highest, the most prominent prize for the Counter-Reformation in the whole of the 16th century. Right. So you've got an archbishop who had gone off the rails, who had been primate of all England, who had led England into the worst sort of wickedness. You really got to force this man to grovel. And they did, and they did, and they did. And it looked as if it was going to work. And do we get on to the great dramatic last story now?
But actually, for you, if you don't mind, so why does he recant? And then
we'll, Well, I think a mixture of things. There is this basic feeling that God had put the monarch there, and if God had made a decision to put Mary there, well, what do you do with that? Do you obey? Do you resist? Ponet had one answer. I think Cranmer had another. There is the effect of imprisonment, solitary confinement. Cat and mouse, he was released into the extremely swish environment of Christchurch under house arrest, dining at high table for a bit, then back to prison. And then with a very interesting jailer, a man called Nicholas Woodson, who I didn't really appreciate how important he was when I was writing the book. He is a very interesting Oxford figure who lived in a great mansion, which is where Oxford Station is now.
Oh, okay.
It had been an Augustinian priory. He was also church warden in the parish of St. Thomas, but also much more a university administrator. Very involved in the foundation of the ultra-Catholic St. John's College. So this is Nicholas Woodson, not the simple, humble jailer who was seen to work his magic on the prisoner, but a very subtle operator being backed by high authority, working on Cranmer psychologically and forcing him. There's a terrible narrative of this, actually, from a Catholic point of view, breaking down Cranmer's spirit, forcing him back towards Mother Church. So it's a classic story of prison pressure, which the 21st century would understand very well.
And you get this recantation, and it's a big public event, isn't it? It's a, you know, everybody's watching, and there's a, it's published, and yet they make a mistake, because I think it's signed by, you know, some, well, either way, it's received with mockery rather than has the impact they wish.
No, it's even more interesting than that, because this is one of the first great occasions of public print, because they distribute the recantations to the crowd, so they've all got a copy.
Yeah.
Extraordinary piece of technology. But the trouble was that Cranmer, who was then forced to read it, altered the last piece, altered the last few sentences, which had said that he rejected his Protestant writings, and instead said he rejected his recantations. He caused utter consternation in the church. Absolute confusion broke out. So he was hustled out of the church. And there's an account of a Spanish friar walking along with him, muttering in fury and agitation, "You didn't say it, you didn't say it."
Right.
And then he's off to the bundle of wood in Broad Street. And the fire.
Right. So I was walking down Broad Street the other day, and I passed one of the, you know, vast numbers of groups of tourists, and I heard the tour guide there saying, "This unworthy hand," just as I passed by.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary story on a personal level, and it's an extraordinarily important event for the future of Protestantism in England, isn't it?
Completely, because if he had not repented, if he had repented and become a Catholic once more, it would have been the biggest prize that the Catholic Church gained during the 16th century. Mm. Instead of which, he reigned on their fate. Mm. He completely ruined the occasion and gave Protestants hope, because Protestants were totally demoralised by the failure of Queen Jane and the taint that they were traitors to God's choice of queen. Mm. Now there was a figure to focus on. Alongside, it has to be said, two earlier bishops, Latimer and Ridley, whose fates had been much more straightforward. They had never wavered, but now this greatest prize had been won back for the Protestant Reformation.
So that's the story of his life, as it were. A couple more questions. What would he have thought of Anglicanism, do you think? We may have covered this. But
Anglicanism, oh no, I don't think we have really, because Anglicanism in its 19th century creation, and it's only a 19th century word really, is a sweetly reasonable middle ground via media, middle way between Rome and Geneva, you might say. Rome and a real Protestant Reformation. Cranmer wouldn't not have understood that, because how can you have a middle way between truth and Antichrist? You can't. So he wouldn't accept middle way. If there had been a middle way, he would have meant the compromise between the Lutheran Reformation and the Reformed Reformation. He deplored that there was a split and would have loved to have been a mediator there, but nothing in the Anglican way at all. And the respect for history in Anglicanism, the love of choral music, he showed no signs of that at all. So in no way was he an Anglican, except that he produced this extraordinary liturgy, which could be used as if it were the book of such a church. And it has been used in such a way ever since.
Yeah, and a very beautiful bit of piece of work it is.
And wonderful. Yeah. He had a gift for language that lasts. Mm. And not a man who made jokes.
Right.
Not a man who...
Not many laughs on the guy.
No. I got very few jokes in my joke card in my index.
Right.
But a man who had an instinct for the words which you can say again and again without them sounding banal or dull or boring. That's a unique gift and a completely, of course, accidental gift. That's not why Henry VIII appointed him Archbishop of Canterbury. But he just had it and could use it to gather up the many attempts at English translation of the liturgy, which had already existed, and turn them into a single, welding them, if you like, into a single book, the Book of Common Prayer.
And it, despite a few revisions, that it survives all the way through, the core of it.
It was tweaked in a slightly Catholic direction in 1662. And you can see them being a bit embarrassed by this and a bit embarrassed by that and changing them. I mean, the most famous one is that Cranmer had said, what happens to the leftover bread and wine at the end of communion? Well, the curate shall have it to his own use is Cranmer's direction. And that lasted up to 1662 when it was taken out. Because what that means, of course, is that this bread and wine having been consecrated is just bread and wine still. And the High Church Anglicans of 1662 didn't like that. But by and large, it is Cranmer's text, Cranmer's words, and they've been an extraordinary vehicle of English language. Mm. Because far more actually than Shakespeare or the Bible, these are the words which people actually said.
Yeah.
And an Anglican service is a dialogue, a drama, involving the whole congregation. So... And while most of the population went to Church of England churches, which is basically 1800 and before that, then that was the language of the people. Mm. And it structured the way we speak English.
The last question, then, sum up Cranmer for me, if you can, in words of one syllable. What are we left with at the end of it?
Well, he was the still centre of a turbulent Reformation. Without him, it would have floundered after Thomas Cromwell's death. It didn't. Instead, it expanded. He did create a workable form of worship, which curiously satisfied the majority of those worshipping up to the 20th century. And he left a standard for prose, which he's there with the giants. He's there with the creators of William Tyndale, the Bible, and the creators of Shakespeare. They are artists in a language which has accidentally become a world language. But even at the time, the 16th century is the time when languages really sort of coagulate. French, German, it's printing, it's the influence of humanist scholarship, new words appeared, and you need controls on that process, you need exponents of it, and he's one of the big ones.
Okay, thank you. That's very good. Anything else I should have asked you about Thomas Cranmer that I did not?
Well, I think we went over everything in the box.
Excellent.
The box.
Very good. All right, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
I really appreciate it. Lovely. Thank you.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.